In Ukraine's east, soldiers continue firing mortars from dug-in positions against Russian invaders. How important is the city of Bakhmut to Ukraine?
If Russian forces take control of it, then they move much closer to big cities like Kramatorsk and Slovyansk, and basically they will get control of certain roads as well. And that is, of course, one of the most important things in terms of the logistics and strategy.
And later in the program, how our soccer club in Kyiv stepped in to help create a safe space for medical care. Today is Friday, October 28th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian soldiers continued holding their position against Russian forces on the outskirts of the eastern city of Bakhmut using mortars fired from holes dug into the ground. Video provided by the Associated Press showed these positions, as well as the troops loading and firing the shells.
33-30. Заряжай.
Russian forces continued to bombard the Donetsk region on Thursday, making slow gains. But the Ukrainians dug in and are steadfast. A Ukrainian soldier, speaking to the AP, said that sometimes the Russians almost break through the lines, but that the soldiers push them back, preventing Russian movements. Though, he said, it was hard to predict what will happen. And joining us from Kyiv with more is Anna Chernikova.
I should say that the city of Bakhmut, for the moment, is one of the main strategic points for Russian forces after they lost Liman and after they basically lost the battle for the east part for Kharkiv region. Because basically, the city of Bakhmut is a city that was under Ukrainian control for all this time. And this is one of the most, literally, the most shelled spot on the territory of Ukraine, if we compare with anything else, because this city is under constant shelling during all this time, taking into consideration its location, its Donetsk region, and its basically the end. It's basically the end of the controlled part of Ukraine for the moment in the Donetsk region.
Anna, what's the strategic value of Bakhmut should Ukrainian forces not be able to hold it?
If Russian forces take control of it, then they move much closer to big cities like Kramatorsk and Slovyansk, and basically they will get control of certain roads as well. And that is, of course, one of the most important things in terms of the logistics and strategy. So I should say that the city of Bakhmut for the moment is the main goal. At least this is what we hear from the intelligence and from the Institute for the Study of War. This is the main goal for Wagner group, which is actually fighting at that area. And for Wagner group, it is an important spot because then they can show, if they take over the control, then they can show that they are actually successful. And what we see in terms of the rhetorics at the moment, that Wagner group and Kadyrov group, they are trying kind of to say that we are successful and the rest of the Russian army not. And we are basically the main ones in terms of the battlefield there. So this is how it looks for the moment. And of course, Bakhmut and Ukrainian forces are defending Bakhmut very, very much. And of course, this is understandable because this is an extremely, extremely important city for in the region now and always actually was. So I should say that when we look in general at the front line, Kherson and Bakhmut would be in the spotlight for some time from now on.
Anna, you mentioned cities that are in the spotlight, and Bakhmut is in the east. It's in the Donbas region. But what about some of the fighting that's taking place elsewhere? We've been talking about Kharkiv, which is in the south. But what about other cities that are currently under shelling and fighting?
Yes. As we can see, Dnipropetrovsk region and Mykolaiv region and actually the cities, the central cities of these regions, Mykolaiv and Dnipro, They are also under constant fire and attacks because these are bordering cities, bordering regions to the frontline area. And Mykolaiv is basically on the way from Kherson to Odessa. So this is also a strategic area, and it is under Ukrainian control. And the city of Mykolaiv gets also constant shellings. And today, again, Russian forces shelled the city. This is what we know from the local authorities, that actually the city of Mykolaiv was shelled with S-300 missiles. For the moment, we know that civilian areas were under attack in the region and in the city itself. And in the city, it was an administrative building, a three-story administrative building, and it was completely destroyed. This is according to the representatives of the military administration of the city of Mykolaiv.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv, thank you very much for taking the time to share with us what is happening there on the ground.
Thank you, Steve.
United Nations Security Council members on Thursday slammed Russia over its claims that the United States and Ukraine are violating the convention prohibiting the use of biological weapons as a result of activities being carried out at biological laboratories in Ukraine. Deji Ebo is the director and the deputy to the High Representative of the United Nations Office for Disarmament Affairs.
As High Representative Nakamitsu informed the Council in March and May of this year, the United Nations is not aware of any such biological weapons programs. This remains the case today.
And Linda Thomas Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, chastised Russia for calling a meeting that she said was solely to spread disinformation.
We all know these claims are pure fabrications brought forth without a shred of evidence. And I would even venture to say the Russian delegation knows these charges are fabricated, but they dutifully carry out marching orders from President Putin. Still, I must take this opportunity to set the record straight. Ukraine does not have a biological weapons program.
On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin insisted that what he calls a special military operation in Ukraine was still achieving its goals, and that the West's dominance over world affairs was coming to an end. Reuters' Tamara Lindstrom has those details.
During a 3.5-hour Q&A session Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin showed no regrets over his war in Ukraine.
World domination is what the so-called West bet on in its game. But that game is, without doubt, a dangerous, bloody, and I would say filthy one. It's one that denies the sovereignty of countries and nations, their distinctiveness and uniqueness, disregarding the interests of other states.
Taking questions from audience members who lavished him with praise.
You have a lot of supporters and a lot of lovers for Russia and mainly for President Putin.
Putin hardly mentioned Ukraine, instead railing against the West. The Russian president appeared confident and relaxed, a marked contrast from stiff, formal, and uneasy public appearances early in the 8-month-old war that had drawn questions about his health. Putin said liberal Western leaders had undermined traditional values around the world and forecast an unpredictable and dangerous future.
Мы стоим на историческом рубеже.
We are standing at a historical frontier. Ahead is probably the most dangerous, unpredictable, and at the same time, important decade since the end of World War II.
He made no mention of Russia's battlefield setbacks of recent months or his escalation in response, such as calling up hundreds of thousands of reservists, which has led to thousands of men fleeing abroad. Leaders in Kyiv dismissed his speech as fighting on the ground appears to have slowed in recent days, with Ukrainian officials saying tough terrain and bad weather had held up their main advance in the southern Kherson province. Russia has ordered the evacuations of civilians from the region it holds, but Kyiv said Russia is reinforcing the area with freshly called up reservists. Putin on Thursday repeated Russia's latest allegation that Ukraine was planning to use a so-called dirty bomb to spread nuclear material, which the United States, Britain, and France have called transparently false. Meanwhile, Kyiv said Russia was pressing ahead with a campaign to destroy critical infrastructure ahead of the winter with drone and missile strikes. A senior Russian foreign ministry official also warned this week that Western commercial satellites could become targets for Russia if they determine them to be involved in the war in Ukraine. The White House Thursday vowed any attack on U.S. infrastructure would be met with a response.
That was Reuters reporter Tamara Lindstrom. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The White House says the Biden administration supports the people of Iran and their right to peaceful protests, and that there may be some cooperation between Iran and Russia in cracking down on Iranian protesters. VOA's Cindy Sain is up next.
Wednesday marked 40 days since the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, the Iranian woman who died in hospital after being detained by Tehran's morality police for allegedly wearing her hijab improperly. In death, Amini has become the symbol of anti-government protests across Iran and solidarity protests around the world, like this one in Berlin, Germany, and this one in Saqqez, Iran, at the cemetery where she's buried. The White House press secretary said Russia may be helping Iran crack down on the protests.
We are concerned that Moscow may be advising Tehran on best practices to manage protests, drawing on Russia's extensive experience in suppressing open demonstrations.
An expert told VOA it is plausible that Russia could be providing Iran with expertise on how to get the six-week-old protest under control. Alex Fatanka is director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute. He spoke to VOA via Skype.
It's easy to say, well, the Iranian regime has been mastering the art of suppression and cracking down for decades, they surely don't need Russia's help. And I think there's a lot of justification for that line of argument. But there are other things perhaps the Russians can help the Iranian regime with, particularly in terms of sabotaging Iranian public's access to things like the internet and other means of communication.
Fatanka said Russian President Vladimir Putin has a long history with Iran's top leaders. Here again, Alex Fatanka.
Look, Vladimir Putin has known Ali Khamenei, the Iranian supreme leader, for about 22 years. There's a working relationship, there's a level of trust that Khamenei arguably doesn't have with any other foreign leader. And Khamenei believes that the survival of the Islamic Republic is more likely to happen if Russia supports this regime than if it didn't or if it was neutral.
The United States, the United Kingdom, the European Union, and Israel have confirmed that Russia has used Iranian Shahed 136 drones, known as kamikaze drones, to attack civilians' homes and critical infrastructure in Ukraine. Moscow denies that Iranian drones are being used in Ukraine. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, Russian journalists who continued to work independently in the country came under significant pressure, so much so that many have been forced to leave. Anna Rice narrates this story.
Mikhail Rubin, deputy editor-in-chief of the investigative news outlet Proyekt, continues to do his job from outside Russia, like hundreds of other Russian journalists who fled the country following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. In 2021, Proyekt was included on a Russian government list of undesirable organizations, and its journalists were labeled foreign agents. Rubin weathered years of threats over Proyekt's coverage of President Vladimir Putin's inner circle before leaving in 2021. First, a high-ranking official warned Rubin that what he was doing was dangerous. Next, unknown men broke into his parents' apartment, screaming, "Isn't your son ashamed to sell out his homeland?" Then police raided Rubin's apartment in June 2021 and placed his passport in front of him.
I took it as a hint and decided not to test my fate after that.
Екатерина Фомина, a journalist at the investigative portal called iStories, also left Russia. Russian authorities labeled the media outlet a foreign agent in 2021, and 2 days before the war, it was added to the list of undesirable organizations. After learning about the listing in March, members of iStory's team unanimously decided to leave Russia. But, Femina adds, leaving Russia was never her plan. At first, she was uneasy about iStory's being labeled an undesirable, but that soon changed. The mass killings in Bucha, Ukraine, became the turning point.
I realized that the enemies of the people, criminals, extremists, and undesirables are not us. So I don't care what the Russian Federation calls me, because I know that Russia, its governments and authorities are actual terrorists and enemies of the people, not us.
Organizations on the so-called undesirables list are prohibited from working in Russia, and those that continue to help these organizations can face administrative penalties or criminal charges. Femina says that despite the risks, Russians inside the country are reaching out to the team.
Because of this war, people are terrified, but they are ready to share what they know, tell stories about lawlessness that takes place in Russia.
As of late October, at least 12 journalists are facing charges in Russia related to the war coverage and face up to 10 years in prison. Galina Arapova, senior media lawyer and director at the Mass Media Defense Center, says Russia has been intentionally passing vague laws.
Censorship has gone rogue, so laws and regulations are being changed to have a chance to target anyone if the need arises.
In many cases, this strategy has worked. Hundreds of journalists have left Russia since the start of the war, but that hasn't stopped many of them from doing their job. For Anusha Vitisyan in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
The increasingly dire nuclear warnings regarding the war in Ukraine have brought back a relic of the Cold War into discourse in Germany, shelters to protect the public from a conflict on their soil. Reuters visited two such facilities, one decommissioned by the government and another made for private use. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda has that story.
This is Robert Schweinbacher, and he's taking us on a tour of a fallout shelter here in Cologne, Germany, designed to protect over 2,300 people from a nuclear war. It's decommissioned. It's not in use. It's a relic. Schweinbacher is the head of the Association for the Documentation of the Cold War in Germany, when half the country was behind the Iron Curtain. Here's the water treatment facility. Here's the kitchen. Just look at this old phone. But the reason we're here is decidedly more current. Earlier this year, the German government announced it's actually re-examining facilities like these, the ones that weren't decommissioned, and even considering upgrading them because of the war in Ukraine. The country had 2,000 in the 1960s and was in the process of slowly shutting them all down. Only 599 are still in service. And there are other crisis preparations. Coming up in December, the country is going to test all of its disaster warning sirens simultaneously, complete with text messages to every person's mobile phone. They're calling it Warning Day, and it's only the second time in the nation's history that it's been done. Towns across Germany are also getting ready for scenarios like power outages. Schweinbacher's facility is built into a subway station, and even though it's not in service, suddenly it's getting inquiries from people wondering, can they use it in the event of a once unthinkable situation? Imagine thousands of men, women, and children of all ages closely packed. There are no showers.
Das ganze Ding heißt im Volksmund Atombunker.
The whole thing is popularly called a nuclear fallout shelter, but strictly speaking, it's a civil defense facility. The big difference between a bunker and a civil defense facility is that a bunker can possibly take a direct hit. This facility absolutely cannot. Right now, there are no people sitting here, but if you imagine people sitting here on the left and on the right, then it's like running a gauntlet. If they don't pull their feet in on time, then it's a bad trip hazard. In other words, the social tension is relatively high in a case like this. We also have children playing and running through here.
It's important to remember that many older Germans experienced the Cold War firsthand, when Germany was a major focal point for the armies and espionage of the Soviets and the West. Ukraine is only a 9-hour drive from Berlin. There's no immediate threat, but a survey by an insurance company this month suggests 42% of Germans fear a war involving their country, up from 16% last year. Mark Schmeichen is with a company called BSSD, which in English stands for Bunkers Shelters Systems Germany. They make shelters for private citizens. It's a niche industry, but regardless, it's reporting a major uptick in business. They told us they typically make about 100 sales a year. Now, after the war started, they say they've already seen a 300% increase.
Before, we always had 100 to 300 hits on our website, and on February 25th in the morning, we were at over 10,000 hits. It was the same with the telephone. While the attack on Ukraine was going on, our phone suddenly started ringing. I would say almost every second or 10 seconds. So that at first, we didn't really know what was happening.
Hopefully, these will never have to be used.
Matthew LaRotonda of Reuters News. And finally, when the Russian military burned down a local medical dispensary near Kyiv, many were left without a place to get medical care. But that's when a Ukrainian soccer club stepped in. Anna Kostachenko brings us that story to round us out.
This outpatient clinic and dispensary in the village of Kurivshina is being rebuilt just 6 months after it was destroyed by the Russian military.
The clinic will be completely new and modern.
Help came unexpectedly. The Dynamo football club, a professional club based in Kyiv, found out about the destroyed clinic and used money from their own personal club fund to help rebuild. They wouldn't say how much they donated. The clinic serves a vital role in the community. More than 5,500 local citizens use this facility, says director Ruslan Surzhenko.
It was an outpatient clinic that had family doctors and pediatricians working there. It was destroyed on March 5th after Russians shelled it. They burnt it to the ground.
Surzhenko believes the clinic was purposely destroyed. The Russian military also targeted the clinic's only ambulance.
The Russians saw special medical signs, yet they simply shot at the car. The windows were completely shattered, and the roof was destroyed by the blast wave.
Local resident Halina Kanderska lives just across the road from the clinic and says she witnessed what happened.
There was a loud roaring sound. We cracked the window open and saw a bunch of tanks approaching. Five or six occupiers sitting on each tank. They were shooting from machine guns and after a while started firing from the tanks.
The clinic was renovated shortly before the war started, so there was no money in the local budget to restore the destroyed building, according to Olga Kushnir, who helps run the clinic.
The whole building was renovated less than 2 years ago, so we were devastated that our freshly renovated clinic was ruined.
With help from Dynamo, the clinic is planning on reopening its doors in November of this year. Anna Kostyuchenko for VOA News, Kyiv Region, Ukraine.
And that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with the latest developments by visiting us online at voanews.com. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.